Nebraska.
Thank you. Please be seated.
The Supreme Court is now in session.
This is the matter of the hospitalization of HR. Counsel, are you ready? Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. After years of deteriorating relations with her homeowners association, on December 2nd, actually 2014, the homeowners association, through their lawyer, signed a petition for authorization for evaluation, involuntary evaluation. But that petition was not filed for 3 days until the afternoon of December 5th. An ex parte hearing was held that same afternoon, and an hour and a half or so later, the magistrate issued a recommendation that the order be granted. HR was taken into custody that evening while she was lighting Shabbos candles, and confined at API over the weekend. On Monday, the hospital determined that she did not meet hospitalization or commitment criteria and discharged her. This appeal really covers two primary issues. One is that the procedure employed by the Superior Court did not comply with that part of the statute that requires a screening investigation be conducted or ordered. And it's our contention that such a screening investigation is required in order for, first, certainly to comply with the statute. It's mandatory, and the state as amicus agrees that it's mandatory. But also that in order to comply with due process, that screening investigation is an integral part of it, including that the respondent is to be interviewed if possible. So when you look at due process and the requirement that the process is required, you know, is required depending on the circumstances, I think if you're looking at dispensing with formal notice and an opportunity to be heard, that the screening investigation sort of, it certainly allows the respondent to present his or her side of the story to the screener, which presumably is somewhat neutral. And so I think that it's necessary that that statute be followed, not only to follow the statute, but for due process.
The statute says that the screening process should include an interview of the respondent, if possible.
Correct.
Do you agree that, given the words, if possible, that it's not mandatory that it be done in every case?
I think the screening investigation is mandatory. The interview, only if possible.
Not in every case.
Yeah, if it's not possible. Right. Yes, Your Honor. It's also our position that in order to find the statute compliant with due process, that this court should hold that the screening investigation should also consider whether or not there's a less restrictive alternative. That's a fundamental tenet of substantive due process for fundamental rights, for deprivation of fundamental rights. And in this case, in these situations, that's really an important thing, because it's not really necessary in all cases to confine someone and bring them into the hospital. There often are measures short of that that can deal with the situation.
Such as
talking to the respondent and trying to find out problems and see what might help the person.
Isn't that requirement implicit in the requirements for hospitalization, that the respondent be gravely disabled or pose a serious danger to themselves or other people?
Well, Your Honor, I think this particular process is before that determination is made. And I think even if someone is, say, gravely disabled, it doesn't mean that they wouldn't accept help that was short of confinement. As I mentioned, the state agrees that the screening investigation is mandatory, but doesn't want there to be rigid requirements imposed. It's hard to disagree. I don't really disagree with that as a broad matter. I would say that it seems to me that reliance on the...
Let me take you back to your lesser restrictive alternative again, because I'm troubled by this. Because what we're at a probable cause hearing for an emergency evaluation. What would be the lesser restrictive alternative to ordering the evaluation?
There's this assumption that just because someone is experiencing these kind of problems that they need to be hospitalized, and that's just not the case. There are...
The question is whether or not the person's going to be evaluated, isn't it?
Well, I think the screening investigation is also something of an evaluation as well.
Isn't the screening investigation to determine probable cause?
Yes.
Not whether the person actually is gravely disabled or a danger, but probable cause.
Well, I think the screening investigation is whether the person alleged to be mentally ill as a result of that condition is gravely disabled or to present a likelihood of serious harm to self or others.
Yeah, but whether it's been alleged enough to warrant an emergency examination.
Yes. Yeah.
What would be the lesser restrictive alternative to an emergency examination?
Maybe the, I feel like I've answered that question. I mean, from my perspective, one of the things, probably the most important thing, is to engage with the person and find out what the problems are and try and address those problems, short of taking the person into confinement and all that kind of trauma and results from that. Now, I think, especially because you've got, presumably in most cases, a screening investigation would be ordered by the court for a mental health professional, and it seems to me that that mental health professional should be capable of considering whether or not there are less intrusive or less restrictive alternatives and have that be a possibility.
It seems to me, though, and I'm having trouble with your argument also, because at this stage, all the court is trying to do is determine whether there's probable cause. The court is not making a finding, you know, based on the testimony of a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something like that. The court is just trying to determine, is there probable cause to have this person required to undergo screening?
But why wouldn't it be okay to have the screener look and see if there's something less restrictive?
The question is probable cause. If the screener were to evaluate the respondent and say there's not probable cause, that's the end of the story. Case is over, right? If the judge agrees. But if there's probable cause, then we proceed to the next level.
And I think that the probable cause determination is also should consider a less restrictive alternative. And one of the things that troubles me is that even a very short confinement, in this case over the weekend, is a very large deprivation of rights. And I think that even though it's a probable cause proceeding, that the person has constitutional rights, and that would include less restrictive alternative. But, you know, I can,
but
you know, understand
the other argument, which is that it shouldn't have been an ex parte proceeding. Could those rights be better protected if, in the absence of an emergency, the respondent were given notice of this petition and permitted to respond to it prior to the order being issued?
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of our points. Our main point.
And was an emergency alleged here?
I don't really think so.
In the petition? Was there? I mean, there's a discussion in the petition of years of confrontation, threats, aberrant and widely swinging behavior and the dog danger, owns a German Shepherd and is unable to control it, et cetera. But was there any indication in this petition that this was an emergency that required an ex parte hearing, analogizing it really to the injunctive relief situation where you don't get an ex parte injunction unless there's an emergency that would really cause a problem if you were to notify the other side?
My view is there was no emergency alleged, and that when there is no emergency or exigency, the person is entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard.
And the fact that the statute presumes that you may even want an interview in the screening process with a respondent would indicate that at least the legislature contemplated that not every one of these would be a surprise to the respondent when the order was finally issued, correct?
Yes, and they are now, I think, most often. And I would also point out that the statute says after receiving the screening investigation, the court may issue an ex parte order. It's not required to issue an ex parte order. And if the screening investigation doesn't reveal any kind of emergency, I think that there could be a
It's the emergency that would be required for the ex parte aspect of the order. I mean, if the respondent were given notice, you had a hearing and the respondent were there, and the trial court made a determination that there was probable cause to require the order, that wouldn't be a problem, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is it your position that the screening investigation has to be conducted by someone other than a judicial officer?
No, the statute says the court may conduct or order a mental health professional that's, you know, contracted with by the...
So that's not an infirmity in this procedure from your perspective?
Excuse me?
That's not an infirmity in this procedure from your perspective, the lack of having a mental health professional involved from the outset?
Well, there wasn't... I mean, the court didn't conduct it either. It's our view that an ex parte hearing cannot be a screening investigation because you just hear one side. Now, the state makes the point that under what's called a police officer application, a doctor or a police officer can have someone, you know, brought in without any judicial involvement at all, and then may file, the hospital may file an ex parte petition. I think that probably does qualify as a screening investigation at that point. The last thing
here on the petition, that's what the MC-105 refers to, correct? That notice of emergency detention and application for evaluation is attached, is not attached, and then it indicates that the MC-105 may only be signed by a peace officer, psychiatrist, doctor, or clinical psychologist. So this was not a situation where she was already in custody or where a doctor had already taken a look at her.
Right, and I think that's a key distinction between this case and the Daniel G. case, where this court felt that since a person was already in custody, that his rights would be more likely, deprivation of rights would be less, would last not as long without it going through a hearing because he's already in custody. And so by not having a hearing, it was more protective of the person's rights. Where here, you have the person out of custody, and so the opposite is true in that conducting the screening investigation or not having an ex parte hearing when it's not justified is more protective of the person's rights. So, thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Robert Schmidt. Starting in 2009, when HR moved into Seacliff, there was a steady decline in relations between HR and her immediate neighbors, as well as other people within the association. This office, my office, became involved in 2013 on behalf of the association when there were cross petitions for stalking restraining orders filed. the petition of the immediate neighbor, the Colsons, was granted and HR's was denied. HR ultimately was convicted of violating the terms of that restraining order. The situation continued to deteriorate, and ultimately the board felt that they had a person who was engaging in bizarre behavior, who had a very dangerous instrumentality with her, the dog, and the situation was deteriorating over time, and the board met and wrestled with what to do. These people are volunteer board members of a community association.
And just for the record, when did it meet?
It met in December of 2014.
How long before the petition was filed?
Approximately a week, which may put it in late November of 2014. But the point being that as volunteer board members in a community association, they typically are worried about things like making sure the parking lot gets plowed. They are worried about making sure the grass gets cut in the summer. And yet they were confronted with a situation that I wouldn't wish upon any community association board, a person who, to the lay eye, is exhibiting signs of mental illness. For example, videotaping with her iPhone conversations while you're talking with her, taking pictures inside open windows of people's houses, their homes in Seacliff. Her prior German Shepherd killed another dog on the premises.
Did the board discuss calling animal control?
Animal control was called and has been called a very large number of times. As a matter of fact, there have been, I believe, 27 instances of the police being called out to Seacliff in some fashion or another involving. And as I understand it, one of them involved
HR.
My apologies, Your Honor. There was one instance involving the Anchorage Police Department SWAT team being brought out. There was discussion a few minutes ago regarding what was the emergency. Two incidents this past summer, the groundkeeping contractor was attacked and bitten by HR's dog. Was there an emergency 5 minutes before that? We don't know. We have security camera video showing that HR has been pulled over by her dog. And there's also security camera video showing HR standing at her landing with her German Shepherd at her side, barking viciously, while her neighbors across the hall are trying to walk up the stairs and get into their unit.
And what is the relationship between that behavior, allegedly, and her mental illness, allegedly?
The issue that I tie that to is the emergency. You know, I analogize this to them sitting on a powder keg. And for example, this summer when the groundskeeper got attacked by the dog, there was an emergency at the time that that happened, but
was there still an emergency with respect to that incident in November? I mean, there's a long period of time between summer and November.
There's been a pattern of these incidences, and it was a matter of the board was in a situation of, do we wait until someone gets hurt? What is the board's potential liability to the groundskeeper, knowing that there was a dangerous, what they believe to be a dangerous dog on the premises?
Are there rules of the homeowners association that would address these issues?
Yes, there are.
And what did the board do to invoke those rules?
The board has a lawsuit pending in Superior Court for her violation of these rules, including the overly large and aggressive dog.
Let me hone in on my concern. It isn't that the petition was filed. It isn't that the board felt it was responsible to file the petition. I don't understand. If this were just a simple injunctive relief petition and I were the trial judge, given that it was a steady decline, that it had been going on for years, that there were issues from the summer that were part of the pattern, I wouldn't consider hearing this on an ex parte basis. And with an injunction, most injunctions don't deprive people of their freedom, their personal liberty. And so my question is, And perhaps you don't have a position. Why shouldn't the trial court have been required, and why shouldn't we indicate in the future that in this type of petition, if it's filed by a private party, not a psychiatrist, not the police, not the state, but if it's filed by a private party, why shouldn't we require that there be an allegation of emergency in the petition, which I don't see here, before, and some indication of what harm would flow from allowing a respondent to come in and present the respondent's case prior to issuing this order?
The Homeowners Association utilized the process that was available to it.
So you may not have a position.
And had we would have been, the association would not have objected to notice necessarily. Although I do believe that it must be recognized that the association was in a horrible position with a person that it sincerely believed to be mentally impaired, who had ready access to a dangerous instrumentality. Defining an emergency is difficult when at any moment there can be something bad can happen, and in fact has happened.
I'm just talking about emergency defined as the type of emergency that would prevent you from giving notice to the other side, to let them come in on an expedited basis the same day, the next day, just to be there in the courtroom. There was nothing like that.
The ex parte process is what is available to petitioners, and that was what was done in this case.
Let me ask it this way. Is there anything in this record that indicates that it would have been impossible for the magistrate to interview the respondent?
There is nothing in the record that would indicate whether it was or was not impossible for him to contact the respondent.
And do you agree with the reading of the statute that I think is consistent with the state's and the respondent's position, that the statute requires the magistrate to interview the respondent if possible?
The statute does require an interview where possible. I mean, the language of the statute is what it is. Regarding, while this may be the case where this court gives direction to lower courts regarding issuing these sorts of orders on an ex parte basis, the court still needs to address your precedent on the mootness doctrine. And establishing the exceptions to the mootness doctrine, particularly that it be the first time that a person has been involuntarily committed, is a very easy task to do. It has not been addressed here that the exceptions to the mootness doctrine.
Public interest? I mean, if in fact there's a constitutional or a statutory aspect to whether this type of thing should be done ex parte without either bringing the respondent into the courtroom or at least attempting to interview the respondent, wouldn't the public interest exception to the mootness doctrine clearly apply?
I believe that let me try to articulate myself better. If the court uses this case as the opportunity to address standards for granting these sorts of motions on an ex parte basis, that is one issue that can be addressed. On the other hand, addressing the merits, the evidentiary merits of her appeal, the case law makes clear that unless you allege first-time commitment, then the appeal is generally moot.
This case doesn't involve a commitment, does it?
There was a petition for.
There was an emergency examination, but there was no commitment, no 30-day commitment.
There was no 30-day commitment. That's correct, Your Honor. There was a 72-hour involuntary examination by API.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
The hearing itself. I understand from the limited record, at least, that, well, maybe I could have you describe for me the hearing. You were there. You had witnesses. They were all in the courtroom at the same time. Is that correct?
Most, but not all, of the witnesses were there at the same time. We met in the basement of the Nesbitt Courthouse. The clerk of court, the petition was styled Seacliff Condominiums Association, the corporation, as the petitioner. The clerk of court refused to accept the application unless it was an individual naming as the petitioner. I put my name down as the attorney for the petitioner. We waited for about an hour and a half until a judicial officer was found. We went in. I examined six or seven different witnesses, including most of the members of the board of directors of the association and the property manager. The judicial officer asked questions at the conclusion of all of my direct examination, and at the end of the hearing he issued oral findings that he, in about an hour's time, put into a written form.
Did at any time the judicial officer strike any evidence that you were presenting, say that it was inadmissible hearsay, require you to not ask leading questions or anything like that?
No. Not to my recollection, Your Honor. I mean, the transcript's available, but I don't recall that that happened. The follow-on to this, the association remains gravely concerned about the substance of the misconduct, and there is a pending lawsuit and a preliminary injunction motion pending in Superior Court. The board members, everybody who testified against has...
Sir.
I apologize, Your Honor. I apologize. Everybody who has testified against the petitioner, the appellant in this case, has been named as a defendant in that lawsuit for, among other things, statutory tort for the bringing of a bad faith mental health commitment. The association is extremely concerned that testimony given under oath is now being used where the statute clearly says that the remedy for bad faith or filing is criminal investigation, and is seriously concerned about the policy implications of allowing people who bring a petition, testify under oath, to then be sued for violating a statute, AS 4730815, when it appears that the purpose of that statute is to immunize people so that they don't have to fear. I mean,
what does that have to do with this appeal? I mean, I understand the concern, but what does it have to do with this appeal?
We invite this court to utilize this appeal to address that concern, that these people who gave that testimony are now being hailed into court for having utilized the process that is available.
Wouldn't those be issues to raise in that lawsuit?
And they have been. There are also pending motions to dismiss.
So wouldn't it be a little odd for us to reach out and decide something that hasn't been briefed, hasn't been argued, that we don't really have a record on or anything else in this case?
Your Honor, if this court were to decide it wanted to address those issues, it could if it wanted, and if it doesn't, it need not. And unless the court has any other questions, I have nothing further.
Mr. Cotton, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I don't think I'll take that much time. The first point I want to make is that the factual impression that's left by the hearing is vigorously disputed by HR, and I think that really demonstrates the problem with having ex parte proceedings. Is she didn't have a chance to have her say, and they're basically the facts that were testified to are very vigorously disputed. I think Mr. Schmidt left the impression that the lawsuit to enforce the homeowners association covenants or whatever was pending before the petition for here, but I think that it actually was filed once HR appealed this. I guess I can't help but mention that Mr. Schmidt said that HR did not address, the collateral consequences in this case, and that would be pretty hard when she wasn't allowed to participate. I could go into the mootness and public interest exception. I think it's clearly established here. I frankly think that.
But to the point made by opposing counsel, even if we were needing to address the constitutional issue regarding ex parte hearings or the statutory issue regarding failure to interview the respondent, is there any reason that the mootness exceptions would stretch to deciding whether the evidence in this case supported the Superior Court's probable cause determination?
Sykrites thinks that the issue of the sufficiency of evidence to support these proceedings is very important, and that it would be good to give guidance to the to the trial courts. So I think it would be good. Do I think that the collateral consequences doctrine has that been met here in this case? No.
Before you sit down, I have one more question along the lines of things that we've been discussing with both counsel, and that is that you were struggling with this idea of, the potential for addressing an emergency situation compared with, the rights of the respondent to participate in that decision. And I'm wondering what your position is if the statute is strictly enforced to require the magistrate to interview the respondent if possible, then would that satisfy the due process concern for this type of emergency situation?
I think there are other elements in the screening investigation, but I think that would satisfy the notice and opportunity to be heard requirement. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gottstein. Thank you. We appreciate your argument today. We'll take the case under advisement and issue a written decision in due course. The court will be in recess until our next hearing. Thank you.